Television has made the American people familiar with the isolation booth, that soundproof chamber which permits a contestant to speak out to the listening audience, prevents him from hearing the answers of his opponent. Much of world politics has in recent years been conducted in an atmosphere resembling that of the isolation booth. There has been much speech and very little listening. There has been much conversation and very little communication. Except for the narrowest of diplomatic and of press channels, the United States and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics have, during the last decade, for all intents and purposes, been totally isolated, each from the other. Let me pursue this analogy one step further. During the last 6 or 8 months, the isolation booth has, for various reasons, almost entirely disappeared from the television screen. And surprisingly, during that same period of time, the age of isolation booth diplomacy seems to have come to an end in the relations between the two great world powers of East and West. For the first time in more than a decade, there have been a growing number of exchanges of people and of ideas, of art and of music between Russia and the United States. It has occurred in the world of the athlete. American crews have raced on Russian rivers, and Russian hockey teams have skated on American ice. It has occurred in the world of culture. Audiences of the Moscow Opera were thrilled by an American performance of Porgy and Bess. And similarly, American audiences were captivated by the exuberant brilliance of the Mosayef ballet dancers. The American von Kleiburn won a grand prize in the Russian piano contest, and the Russian Emil Gilels was welcomed with the highest of critical acclaim to American symphony halls and opera houses. There has been an exchange of special technical missions. Iowa farmers have visited Russian and Ukrainian peasant cooperatives. Ukrainian agronomists have returned these visits to Iowa homesteads. At international conferences throughout the world, the medical and scientific professionals of both countries have shown an increased willingness to share and to pool papers of importance. And both countries cooperated in gathering the important research data necessary for the experiments of the International Geophysical Year. Now, this growth of athletic and cultural and technical exchange between Russia and the United States is a startling new departure in our foreign relations. It is one which merits our considered attention. There has been, during most of the period of the Cold War, a trickle of tourist trade between East and West. What separates and distinguishes tourism in the last 6 or 8 months from that which went previously is on the deals with the stature of those who have visited each of the countries and the nature of the welcome which they have received when they came there. American industrialists such as Eric Johnson and Cyrus Eaton have visited Russia, and important American officials such as Senator Hubert Humphrey, ex-presidential candidate Adlai Stevenson, the ex-First Lady, Mrs. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, have gone to Moscow. These are persons of some importance on our national scene. It is significant that they went to Russia, but it is even more significant that the Russians set great store by their visits. Nikita Khrushchev, the head of the Russian state, not only accorded them interviews which were lengthy and far from perfunctory, but he took great pains in these interviews to be moderate in the defense of Russian policies and to emphasize and underscore what he terms the Russian desire for peace and for coexistence with the West. It is significant that the deputy premier of the Soviet Union, their second in command, Anastas Mikoyan, has visited the United States. It is even more significant that wherever he went, with whomever he met, among our leaders of industry and of labor, of the press and of government, these discussions were conducted with a minimum of recrimination. And there was an emphasis on both sides at all times of our desires for peace and for establishing better relations between ourselves. Senator Humphrey and Mr. Khrushchev spoke for most of a working day, almost 8.5 hours, on problems of mutual relationships. Mr. Mikoyan met the American people on a national televised program of Meet the Press, and for more than an hour discussed before the bar of American opinion problems of our national and mutual relationships. These and other such discussions and interviews have caused the world to pause and to ponder as to their significance, to their meaning. Now, as yet, these interviews have not brought any observable achievement. The Americans who were in Moscow, though they were important in our national life, went there as private citizens without portfolio. They had no specific mission to accomplish. Mr. Mikoyan came to the United States not as the deputy premier of the Soviet Union, but as a self-styled tourist and visitor. And though he quasi-officially requested from the United States some trade credits and some compromises on the Berlin crisis, these were apparently denied them to him by our government. So we cannot point to any immediate achievement of a bettering of international relationships on the basis of a visit so far. And indeed, their importance lies not in any such achievement, but in that which they portend. For our world has for a decade now been engaged in a foreign policy battle based on the principles of military deterrence and military commitment. The language of diplomatic correspondence has been geared to victories in the field of propaganda rather than to serious attempts to arrive at definite proposals and commitments and accommodations between both nations. And often the language of diplomatic correspondence has been more abusive and vilifying than edifying. Indeed, as we look back upon the last decade, it is probably more the patent folly of nuclear disaster and Holocaust than any achievement of the diplomats of either country which has kept our nations from being at one another's throats. These discussions seem to portend that this era of military foreign policy is drawing to a close. It seems to say that the two great opponents and contestants in the battle for world peace and world dominance have yelled themselves hoarse, and that they are tired of policies which have over a decade proven themselves to be far from sanguine in the hope that they hold out for peace and for achievement. The United States and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics have been very much like two families settled in a single neighborhood, each determined for reasons of hatred and reasons of spite to drive the other, by any means possible, out of the neighborhood. And today they do not seem to be eager to welcome the other with open arms. But both seem to have realized that any further obvious or devious attempt to drive the other from the neighborhood is doomed to failure. Each seems to have realized that they are beset by a series of domestic problems, problems of relationship with the other neighbors in the community, that the street that runs in front of their house needs to be paved, that they could better use their energies in 101 more positive programs And so, though without compromising their dislike of each other, they seem to be saying that they will accept for the moment the continued inevitability of the other's presence. And perhaps even when possible, they will cooperate, albeit at arm's length, in programs of neighborhood activity which are mutually beneficial. Mr. Mikoyan seemed to be saying this when, throughout his visits in the United States, he emphasized, and I quote, "We are tired of the Cold War. We wish very much for a hot peace." And President Eisenhower seemed to be responding to this call when he asked Mr. Mikoyan at the close of his visit, and I quote, "to convey to the Russian people the sincere desire of the American people for friendship with them." Mr. Khrushchev seemed to be speaking in these terms when, in an interview with Senator Humphrey, he asked the senator, could not our nations better compete economically than militarily? You recall that just last week our own president mused out loud at a press conference whether it was not patent that both of our nations were tired of the burdens of the Cold War. We honestly sought some way to free ourselves of the impasse into which we have been brought. Now, the United States and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics are separated by a vast chasm of distrust and dislike. Our philosophies and our ideologies are totally dissimilar. When we speak in the world of human values, we hardly speak the same language. Our world has been inured to protestations of peace because almost every military commitment and armament program which was developed during the Cold War was rationalized as a program for peace. It is still too early, it is still moot, whether the United States and Russia will be able to upgrade the level of their diplomatic relationship from one of open political and military belligerency to one of fiercely competitive and yet not designedly cutthroat competition in economics and in diplomacy. Mr. Mikoyan, at the close of his visit, said, I quote, "The wind still blows cold, but it is the wind of spring." We pray that it may be. But as yet, it may only be an unseasonable thaw such as we in Cleveland experienced in the past week. It would be folly for any of us to believe, my friends, that at this moment we are closer to a stable world than we were a year ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. But it would be equally foolish for any of us, I believe, to consider, to forget that this thaw in diplomatic relationships, this program which permits our countries to meet face to face, person to person, and to exchange ideas, it would be folly for us to forget that if exploited courageously and intelligently, this new era of personal relationships may yet give us sufficient flexibility to indeed change the direction of our national relationships. We should not believe that even in our lifetime, the era of Russian and American competition will be brought to an end. It will not. We do not see eye to eye in the world of values. We do not see eye to eye in the world of economics. We do not see eye to eye in the world of politics or of philosophy. Both of us have a different vision of the one world which we are seeking to establish. And yet, as every businessman knows, one can live in a world with competitors, but one cannot live in a world with an anarchist who is determined to burn out our business and to destroy our person. And the hope which these conversations give to the world is not so much that it will make our world one world of peace without any arguments between the contending powers, But it is the hope that we will be able to establish a condition of relative stability in which the two countries and other countries will compete in the arena of ideas in the world of trade, but will not be hurling at one another the rocket shafts of atomic destruction. The United States has feared Russian military adventure since the end of the Second World War. We have had reason for these fears. The Russian gospel is expansionistic. It envisages a world converted to communist control, and the Russian action swallowing up the satellites of Eastern Europe at the end of the Second World War seemed to give us proof, grounds for our fears. But you know, my friends, gospels can be reinterpreted. The Russians seem to have reinterpreted their gospel, not that they have given up the messianist hope of a communist world, far from it, but they now seem to feel that this world will come about because of the certain inevitable economic laws which will bring about change within each of the capitalist countries, change which will inevitably drive these countries into a form of communist government. And it's one thing to fear this inevitable economic law which Russian theory postulates, and it's quite another to fear irresistible communist armies battering down your doors and your boundaries. Such an astute observer as Adlai Stevenson left his interview with Mr. Khrushchev with a feeling that he was as concerned with the Holocaust and the terror and the misfortune which a nuclear war would bring as any of us would be. And he said that when Mr. Khrushchev speaks of peace, I am convinced that he sincerely means it. And if this be true, then there is reason to believe that we can bargain between ourselves and establish a program of coexistence. Now, I'm not suggesting that we let down our armaments. We should not. It was right that we build up our armaments to prevent Russian expansionism 10 years ago. It's equally correct that we continue our program of defensive strength to prevent any Russian miscalculation or any Russian reinterpretation again of its gospel. But I would submit that if the Russians have sincerely come to the conviction that they will exchange economic competition for military competition, then if our diplomats would realistically and hard-headedly seek to work out bit by bit the jigsaw puzzle of thousands of pieces which are the tensions between our two countries, then indeed we may be able to move from brink of war to brink of stability. You know, there is one factor in our national interrelationships which many of us have forgotten. It is this: that as much as we have feared the Russians, so much have they feared us. It is a dogma of Russian religion, of communist religion, that as the communist countries become more successful and more established, and as the world grows to realize the menace which communism represents, the businessmen who control, according to their gospel, the governments of other nations, will become more and more worried that they will retaliate by economic pressure and by military adventure. It's always been close to the Russian heart, the communist Russian heart, the fear, the businessman warlord. And this is not an act, a statement of Russian propaganda. This is an act of faith on the Russian part. For he cannot see how the businessmen whose businesses are in danger of being taken away from them and given over to the state, how these businessmen will ever make peace with the dynamic inevitability of what they consider to be communist expansion. They fear military adventuring led by Western capitalist businessmen. And as proof of this fear, they cite the counter-revolution of 1919, in which the Western powers financed and manned armies determined to overthrow the Bolsheviks. And since the Second World War, these fears have been fed, rightly or wrongly, by the rearmament of Germany, by the establishment of a ring of rocket bases around the periphery of the Russian subcontinent, and most especially by speeches on the part of certain Americans who counseled, you remember a few years ago, preventive war against the Russian people, wars of liberation for the satellites. And they took these as proof that there is an inevitable conflict directed by the West against them. There is no animal more dangerous than an animal at bay, an animal that feels himself trapped. Perhaps these visits will convince the Russian leadership that the American and the Western European businessman is not the warlord, in quotation marks, that his gospel holds him out and pictures him to be. Indeed, I would read to you this morning a very interesting question and answer, which was directed to Mr. Mikoyan by a man, Orlando Ruggiero, of the radio and television networks of Italy, just before Mr. Mikoyan left this country. Question: does your discovery that Wall Street is inhabited by peacemongers imply any theoretical revision of your views? Answer: in my case, theory and practice do not diverge. Of course, it is a pleasure for me to hear businessmen in conversations express the desire for peace, especially since this is the first time I have heard such things from high representatives of capital with whom I have had an opportunity to converse. However, their theories will have to be verified on the basis of practice, facts, and life. Mikoyan qualifies his recognition of American serious peaceful intents with 101 reservations. But this realization that all American businessmen are not warlords is a bit of communist heresy. And if he had stated this during the era of Stalin, he would have been purged for this heresy. The fact that he could meet the very lair of our business world in Wall Street, in our Union Club here in Cleveland, at the center of the automobile and armament empire in Detroit, with American businessmen, and exchange views on mutual trade, exchange views on the possibilities of working out conditions of peace, I think that these exchange of ideas and the light that it brought to such an important person as Mr. Mikoyan will indeed and can indeed do much to establish peace and to quiet their fears. These talks, unofficial though they have been, between the United States and the Union of Soviet Social Republics mean a great deal. They mean, among other things, that the United States will have to become much more intelligently anti-communist than we have been before. We have been emotionally against communism, but we have not been able to quote chapter and verse of what we call the communist perfidy. And we have seen that the communists can send to us brilliant ambassadors, men who are able to explain away and to rationalize what we felt were heinous Russian crimes. And unless each of us are equipped with the facts of Russian history, unless we can recite these facts and keep them in our minds, we are in danger of mistaking some of the Russian protestations. And we are in danger of overemphasizing the importance of Russian achievements. The speeches and the visits between Russian and American spokesmen mean many things. I think that they have brought home to the both countries a strange but important realization of the vitality and the strength of the other. Everyone who has visited the Soviet Union comes back amazed at the sinews that they have built, at the vitality which they exhibit, at the strength which they show. And this is important. It has quieted once and for all any hope which we have held that there would be a counter-revolution within Russia, that Russian dictatorship would crumple of its own weight. After all, this was the only hope that those who counseled a program of pure military containment had to offer us. And stripped of this one hope, we will perhaps be able to force these people to lead us into some other and more constructive program of international relationship. Realization of Russian strength has also brought an end to all talk of preventive war, wars of liberation. This is to the good. These wars were counseled upon us by our military leaders, some of them, and they would have been wars of folly and wars of self-destruction. And the realization on the Russian part that America is strong and is vital and is energetic is equally important. You're not as liable to challenge another country to the possibility even of war if you realize that that country will hit you a mortal blow in return. It is a dogma of Russian belief that the West is decadent, that communism, that capitalism is on the decline. And so it is again a statement of communist heresy for Mr. Mikoyan, on the basis of what he saw and realized here in America, to state not only that American capitalism exists, but it has had considerable success. In many ways, its success is superior to that of the Soviet Union. The more that the Russians realize that America is strong and is not about to roll over and to play dead, the less they are likely to challenge us, to throw the gauge in our face, and to force this world into a war that neither people wants. These exchanges, then, of ideas and of men have meant much to both countries. They have made the American people aware of the strength and of the achievements of our opponents. They have made us realize that we can no longer be lethargic in our responsibilities to our national life. Mr. Stevenson, upon his return from Russia, spoke of the dynamism of Russian industry and the sluggishness of our own way of life. Their concern with the state and our concern with the self. I think he overdrew the picture. But it is nevertheless true that the Russian challenge has done much to recenter American thinking on the basics of American life, basic values and basic things, and away from material pleasures and leisure. These speeches between our governments, quasi-official representative of our governments, I think will do much to convince the Russian government America is strong and is determined not to obliterate Russia from the face of the globe, but to limit Russia from enforcing her will upon other nations of the globe. And I think this realization will be sanguine. I think it will help the Russian government to determine on other policies less bellicose and less militaristic. We wonder whether the interviews and the meetings which have been held between these powers have any influence upon the Russian people. We all had an opportunity to observe Mr. Mikoyan and to read in our press of his interviews and to make our own judgments. We know that the Russian press is controlled, the radio is completely censored, and the question has been raised whether we are not subjecting ourselves to propaganda without ever having any opportunity to edify the Russian people in return. One does not know. But I came across just last week an interesting report of a speech made by Mr. Igor Mosayev, director of the Soviet dance group, which you remember visited our country in the past year. And I would read to you a few lines of this report. It was one, a speech which he made to some 600 actors, dancers, and musicians on December 11th in Moscow. And the speech was then reprinted in part in the Russian press. And I read it to you not because of the astuteness or the brilliance of his observations of American life, because I think you will see that here is a man who has visited America, who recognized some of our vitality and of our virility and our humanity and the honesty of our intent. And certainly if we can multiply such impressions among others as they return to Russia, they will inevitably make a dent upon the psychology and the conscience of the Russian people. The topic of Mr. Mosayev's speech was the cultural life of America. He began by saying he would concentrate on the positive and leave the shortcomings of the United States to the people responsible for such things. Already he is excusing himself from the usual propaganda elements which every Russian speech must have. At the troops' first appearance at the Metropolitan Opera House, he said, he waited anxiously in the wings for the first applause. Would American audiences react in the same way as Russians? Just at what he thought was the right instance, the American audience burst into applause and cheers. And Mr. Mosayev felt that the show was successful. He commented on the cordiality with which the troupe had been received throughout America in performances, both public and private. Particularly pleasing was a reception in the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles, where after the performance, American movie stars had formed an honor guard for the dancers. Mr. Mosayev said that he found the Temple of Life in New York so infectious that after a few days, he had run everywhere instead of walking. He seemed pleased to tell that there are restaurants in New York of nearly every nationality. He noted the great variety of goods available in stores at reasonable prices. He said that the United States highway system was more marvelous than Germany's. He remarked that he always heard that the United States did not have much to offer in contemporary drama. This, he said, is completely wrong. New York and other cities offer a wide variety of theatrical art, which is both dynamic and contemporary. Two musical shows particularly impressed him, West Side Story and My Fair Lady. These, he said, were the type of production that should be seen in Moscow. He said that of individual American dancers, his view of American individual dancers had led him to believe, and this is a direct quote, that the foundation of an American school of ballet had been laid. His most enthusiastic comments were on American musical life. Every sizable symphony, he said, has a symphony. Every sizable city, he said, has a symphony. Pardon me. He said that superb musicianship and discipline of individual artists allowed different orchestras to accompany his dancers satisfactorily, although the musicians had often received unfamiliar scores only on the morning of the performance. He described the many art museums he had visited, and he implied that Americans enjoyed a very rich cultural life. Now, these observations of American life are not particularly new, but they may be new to Russian audiences. And they speak of an exuberance to American life, which I'm sure the Russian audience is unused to hearing. I think then that these conversations, unofficial and quasi-official that they have been, can be and should become an important area for the development of a new level of diplomatic relationship between East and West. We should encourage these exchange visits. We should not be afraid of them. We should encourage the opportunity of many Russians to come to our own country to see America as it is, not as the Russian gospel and propaganda picture us to be. We should encourage as many Americans as possible to visit Russia and to see Russia as she is, and not as an emotionally overwrought press has often pictured Russia to us to be. It will be up to our two governments to work out now in the years ahead a step-by-step program designed to establish a more stable world. This program can only be built slowly. We should not expect peace overnight. We should not expect any immediate relief of international tension. The problem of Berlin still confronts us. The talks on nuclear disarmament and the control of nuclear testing are still unresolved. But none of these issues are incapable of resolution. All the governments involved, and especially the two central governments, are willing to work towards realistic accommodation of interests and desires. And the enlarging of the channels of communication between the governments permits a flexibility of conversation which I think will ultimately make possible these new accommodations which we so earnestly seek. I think we have come to a time when perhaps indeed, in Mr. Mikoyan's terms, the wind that blows is still a cold wind. It may yet be the wind of spring. Amen.